This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View, a podcast from Morningstar. I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar, Inc.
And I'm Jeff Patak, Global Director of Manager Research for Morningstar Research Services.
Our guest on the podcast today is financial planner Harold Ovensky, who Morningstar Managing Director Don Phillips has often called the Dean of Financial Planning. Harold is chairman of Ovensky & Katz Folds Financial, and he's a retired professor of personal financial planning at Texas Tech University. Harold has been extremely active in the planning community during his career. He's the past chair of the International CFP Council, the CFP Board of Governors, the Board of Examiners, and the Board of Appeals. Harold is a frequent public speaker and has authored several books, including The New Wealth Management. We're thrilled to have him here today. Harold, welcome to The Long View.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Harold, let's start by talking about your advisory practice. It's one of the most established financial planning practices in the U.S. Let's talk about the business model that you employ here, where you charge clients a percentage of their assets under management on an ongoing basis. One thing that we've been seeing is that people are revisiting that business model. We've been seeing new business models come to market, the subscription model and so forth. Can you talk about why you think the AUM model makes sense for your practice?
Yes, and somewhat defensively, because I agree with all the comments that it's really not an appropriate structure for what I believe we do and what our value is. However, having said that, quite a few years ago, we went to a retainer basis and did that for, I think, a couple of years, as I remember, and it was an unmitigated disaster. First of all, the first thing that a new client or new prospect does is convert that retainer to an AUM number. And then as we went on with business, if you're in a retainer and a client adds substantial dollars, they really don't expect that retainer to change. But if they take substantial dollars out, the first thing they do is ask for a reduction in the retainer. In addition to that, our sort of conversion rate of prospects to clients fell off the cliff, because people really didn't understand it. So long and short, I don't disagree intellectually with the suggestion that they're better models, but my professional experience is they don't work. So I do not see us changing from an AUM model at all.
Can you ballpark the percentage of time that you and the planners there might focus on financial planning tasks versus the investment portfolio management?
I would say pretty much all of it we think of is planning. When I did my original book, Wealth Management, I said I considered it somewhat of a specialty of planning. We're focused on the investment aspects, but it's all built around the planning. I mean, we utilize our basic planning software as MoneyGuide, which we use extensively. And so, you know, that's what leads us to designing the portfolio. The actual details of the portfolio design and investments is in the bailiwick of the investment committee. So the practitioners, the wealth managers are not really spending any time on that other than the few that sit on the investment committee and understanding the underlying logic of the design and the investments we're using. But pretty much all of the professionals' time is spent focused on the client and the planning aspects.
Have you explored kind of a dual model where you might have the AUM model for larger, more established clients and some other model in place if the idea is to try to bring on board some younger clients without substantial portfolios who might grow into large clients over time?
Yeah, great question. And the fact of the matter is we're actively discussing and considering what we might do as not an alternative, but sort of as an entry structure for those with less assets. So the answer to that is absolutely yes.
What are some of the other key innovations that you expect to see at a practice like yours in, let's say, the next 10 years, if we had to try to envision what a business like yours is going to look like, what do you think would mark the most important differences?
I think that we're going to be sort of moving back to our roots, at least my roots, going way back, of comprehensive financial planning. Back a zillion years ago, we were fairly passionate. But again, from a business standpoint, that wasn't a very viable solution. Someone would come in with a $2,000 IRA and would say, oh, well, no problem. You know, we need to spend many hours with you getting information, and we'll generate a 100-page report and give you an answer, you know, in a few weeks. That really didn't make a lot of sense. So where I see us moving is more formally integrating or developing the planning process, but doing it as opposed to all at one time, what I call modular comprehensive planning, where when a client comes, you'll first deal with the entry issue, which is typically an investment-related issue. You know, I've got funds, what do I do? And planning, we do the money guide and developing a portfolio and asset allocation and IPS. But then once that's settled and, you know, maybe 3 months, 6 months, the client's comfortable, understands, you know, the next quarterly meeting, and we typically meet quarterly, say, well, let's sit down and let's review your estate planning. And then the next quarter, maybe we'll review your tax planning. And the next quarter, you know, your risk management. So over a period of time, we will have formally addressed all of the classic elements of a comprehensive financial plan. And I think that's the future. There's no secret that what we're doing is becoming commoditized. What we do, I think, is quite different than what a lot of, you know, practices and warehouses do. But to the public, it looks the same. So I think it's going to be important to develop and provide more substantive value to what we do going forward.
So when you say you've been commoditized, what do you mean? You mean the investment management piece is viewed by some members of the public as more or less fungible from firm to firm?
Yeah, exactly. You know, sure, everyone, you know, I can go in, they're going to give me, you know, an asset allocation, and maybe they'll develop an IPS and they'll, you know, pick funds and manage it for me. I say, it may look the same. Obviously, I'm prejudiced. I don't think it's remotely the same. But nevertheless, it seems, and then you have the whole robo, which purports to do the same thing. Again, I think there's a order of magnitudes different in quality of what's delivered in the substance. But still, to the general public, the general investor, pretty much looks like the same service.
And so if you're approached by a prospect, I should turn that around. If you approach a prospect and one of the things that they constructively challenge you with is, well, you know, I can go to a robo and get, you know, many of the same services at a fraction of what you would be charging me. And so what are the things that you would constructively rebut that assertion with? What are some of those key differences that you would outline for the benefit of that prospect to help them appreciate some of the value that you and your colleagues can add?
Well, one of the key differences is I think it's kind of dangerous to plan the quality of the rest of your life based on an algorithm, especially when the people running the algorithm don't know where it came from or how it was developed. I wouldn't want to go to a robot to do my medical checkup, and I'm not going to go on the web to just pick up some forms to do my estate planning. So it's just a simple way of perhaps getting a general idea of where you should be going. Related to that, a couple of other the now professors at NI Tech did a paper on the efficacy of publicly available retirement planning software. And we looked at the universe of what was available out there. I don't remember right now, maybe 20 or so programs. Our premise going in was that it would provide at least good education, maybe not good results, but good education. Our conclusion was pretty much across the board, it's dangerous. The results range from you're going to run out of money in 5 years to, you know, you have enough money to last you the rest of your life. Just simple things. Many of the programs don't ask whether you're a smoker or not. I mean, that has a huge difference in terms of longevity. And the same thing with robo software. It's just not a sound way, again, plan the quality of the rest of your life. Once you decide that you probably need a warm body in between that software and yourself, then it's a question of, you know, what is the experience of the people who are going to be helping you make these decisions? You know, what are their credentials? You know, we have about 30 employees and about 20 of those are CFPs. So what we bring to the table is an extraordinary amount of intellectual capital and experience. You know, it's not a one shoe fits all. You know, one shoe fits nobody. That's the reality of it. And we do know what we're doing, and we're going to be helping you enjoy the rest of your life. So we tell people, we can't make you rich, we can't make you poor. Hopefully we can help you sleep well at night rather and not make you poor. We're not in the business of making people rich. You know, they come to us with the resources they have. Our goal is to help them get reasonable returns at a risk that they can live with in turbulent times. And the other substantial value we add, in fact, when we really earn our money, is when everything's going wrong. You know, when the market's falling apart and people are jumping out of windows, that's when our real value comes, which is, in effect, you know, the hand-holding, the comforting, the reminder, you know, hang in there, why they're okay. You know, let's pull up their plan. Let's go to Money Guide. Let's see, are there any adjustments we need to make? You know, we're there all the time with our clients, particularly during scary times. During good times, everyone looks smart.
Can you give us an example of sort of what one of those interactions would look like? Would you interject in a market inflection point? Would you reach out to clients, or would you look to them to reach out to you? What would be the catalyst for such an interaction?
No, good question. Our goal is to call the client before they call us. So when markets are particularly turbulent, I would write sort of a letter saying, well, look, we don't know where things are going, but this is what's going on now, and this is how we see it. And then we would be on the phone calling clients, particularly the ones that experience told us are likely to be the most concerned, just to talk to them and say, look, why don't you come in? Let's sit down. Let's update your plan. Let's do some stress testing. Let's take a look at your plan and see what happens if the market drops by, you know, 10 or 20%. Are there any adjustments that we need to be thinking of in advance? Basically, communications, but particularly communications in advance as opposed to in hindsight. One of the things that amazes me, and I've been doing expert witness work over 20 years, a lot of the, you know, the arbitrations particularly arise after a bear market. And my experience, what happens is brokers and, much to my surprise, trust officers, and those times, basically, they hide under the desk. You know, they not only don't call, they sort of avoid the phone because they don't know what to say, because all too many have been selling performance in the past. So they don't have an answer. So we don't sell performance. We sell trying to sleep well at night and get reasonable returns.
You said earlier that one size fits none when it comes to some of the off-the-shelf asset allocation guidance. Can you talk about some of the factors that you would look at when customizing an asset allocation mix for someone? Does human capital, what the person does for a living, figure into it? What are the factors that would call for some sort of customized asset allocation mix?
I'd say everything calls for a customized mix because everyone is individual. Human capital, I would say, is pretty low on the totem pole of important factors, as is age. You know, we can have two clients, both the same age and both in the same job, but have radically different outcomes. They may have radically different risk tolerance levels. They may have radically different outside sources of income. And typically, you know, there's a husband and a wife or two spouses in any event, which may be very different. So the things that are important, most important, are what are the client's goals? What do they want to do? It's not like I need fixed number of dollars and that's all I need every year for the rest of my life. I've got kids I need to send to college. I've got some parents I need to help. I want to take a big anniversary cruise 3 years from now. I mean, any and all of those things. So typically when we're working with a client, there'll be 10 or 15 different goals. The important thing is identifying those goals and then quantifying them in both time and dollars. It's not, I want to retire soon and live good. I want to retire in, 3 years and live at this certain standard of living. Then prioritizing those goals. Goals are not chronological. So we need to determine, what goals are most important and what is that level of importance. That's by far the most important thing. And then going into information, characteristics of the clients, because mortality is such a big driver of the planning process, we certainly want to know about their health. We want to know, are they smokers or non-smokers? I mean, all of that can make a huge difference in the ultimate recommendations we might make. And then certainly their risk tolerance. Those are all the elements that are unique to each client, each individual and each couple.
So you have quite a lot of detail on the website about how you approach investment management. And I want to read something to you, and I'm hoping you can help us unpack what it means.
Sure.
So it says, we believe the multi-asset class, multi-manager investment policy model developed for large tax-exempt institutional clients and adopted by wealth management advisors is no longer appropriate for individual investors. We believe that in today's economic environment, a core and tactical satellite portfolio is the appropriate base policy designed for individual investors. What does that mean, core and tactical satellite portfolio, in practical terms, in terms of how you construct your client portfolios?
Yeah, the history of that is we're always looking forward in terms of, planning markets, et cetera. And a number of years ago, looking forward, I concluded that market returns were likely to be substantially lower for a decade or maybe decades than they had been in the past. And we focus on real returns, net of inflation. And having reached that conclusion, I looked at the way we were implementing portfolios that I call the MAMs, multi-asset class, multi-sectors. We typically had maybe 15 or 20 different allocations. And at one point, we had three large cap domestic managers, a growth, a value, a core, even a small allocation to emerging markets. We had three managers, one who focused on Pacific Rim, one who was on the East, and then someone sort of global. And in looking at that, I realized that's horribly inefficient in a retail environment. You have just the transaction cost of rebalancing across all these multiple managers. And just the cost of doing it wasn't a problem when you were getting returns in the, mid to high double digits. But if you believe, as I do, that returns net of inflation and taxes in a balanced portfolio are going to be down around maybe the 4% range or something, every basis point is going to make a huge difference. The problem was nothing had changed in my philosophy. We believe in diversification, domestic, international, small cap, et cetera. And in looking at other possible solutions, I came across what's called core and satellite, sometimes core and explore, which is a really simple concept. The idea is when you look at your equity allocations, instead of taking a little bit of risk in each one of your categories, basically by looking for, an active manager that's going to add some alpha in each area, you take the core of your investments, in our case, that's 80% of the equities, and simply look to capture the market return as cost and tax efficiently as possible. And basically, that comes down, in our case, to ETFs or index funds. And then you take that whole risk budget that you used to spread across the entire equity allocation, and you can concentrate that on what we call the tactical allocation. So the core becomes strategic. That's long term. It changes. It's not buy and forget. It's buy and manage. But it doesn't change very often between domestic, international, large and small, etc. And the satellite is tactical in that the time horizon there is like 1 year. So our criteria there is an investment that we believe forward looking, next year, we'll do net of expenses and taxes. It may be expensive, may be tax inefficient, but net of all of that, we'll do a couple of percent better than the global market. So that's an area in which almost anything goes. The only criteria we have is we want to avoid just a good story. It needs to have some fundamental credibility to the strategy. But that's where we concentrate all the risk budget in that small 20%.
So can you give an example of one of these satellite areas, presumably in a place that you think is more target rich and perhaps gives you the opportunity to participate in greater returns?
It changes all the time. It could be, even though we have a value bias in our portfolio and we overweight value, there are periods in which, you know, value has done extremely well, and we believe in a regression back to the mean. So we've had like a large cap growth allocation in the satellite. We've had positions shorting 30-year treasuries. We've put commodities in there. We've had sector allocations. So again, it can be most anything. There is no specific type of strategy. It might be a structured note. It's pretty open.
Understood. And is there a typical time horizon that you would have when you're entering into one of those positions per the methodology that you're using?
Yeah, the core, the time is an economic cycle, roughly 3 to 5 years. The satellite is a one-year horizon. You know, satellite positions often stay far more than a year, but it's a short-term horizon.
Let's get back to value. Your firm has long employed a value tilt, and value has been kind of going through this long, dark night. Have you been having to reassure clients about sticking with a little bit of a value tilt in their portfolios? Have you been losing patience with value? What do you think will be the catalyst for a resurgence in value stocks?
Haven't really had much response from clients, although, again, we always look to be proactive. So, you know, we talk to them about our thoughts about it. But we have had extensive discussions with our primary value manager, which is Dimensional Fund. I guess honest answer would be to say to reassure ourselves. But, you know, we've been there, done that before. And our conclusion is that the basic concept of a value premium remains viable. You know, it has been a dry spell, but, you know, after reviewing the academic literature and talking extensively to DSA, we're still value believers and still committed to it, and believe that over the long term, you know, planning horizon, we're designing portfolios for 20 and 30 years, and we think that it's still an appropriate allocation. Again, we are definitely not 100% value. We just somewhat overweight our value exposure. Same thing with small cap. You know, there are periods in which small cap doesn't look very attractive, but we still believe that there is a small cap premium that we look to capture over time.
I mean, given one of the things that's a fixture of markets is it's sort of this notion that the only thing that's permanent is impermanence, like price to book is a good example, right? Where some would argue that price to book has lost some of its cachet. It's maybe not the same sort of value measure it used to be. And so knowing that, how do you reconcile yourself with an approach where you're trying to identify certain areas that perhaps are mispriced based on rules of thumb or different constructs that you would use, knowing that they themselves could become passe over time? Do you build in some checks and balances to your process to allow yourself some margin for error in case, you know, one of your tactical ideas doesn't quite work out as you plan, you still can accomplish the client's goals?
When it comes to the issue of, you know, particularly value and price to book, we recognize some of the structural changes and the issues there. And to a large extent, there we're dependent upon those professionals that we look to implement that aspect of the strategy. In our case, that's specifically, you know, DFA. And they too are very well aware of that and sensitive to it and have factored that into their modeling. So our effort is making sure that they're sensitive to our concerns to the extent they agree with it. They're sort of modifying their approach to take that into consideration. Again, we're not picking individual positions. We're determining where we want exposures to, and then our efforts and our due diligence is focused on those professionals that we're looking to implement those particular aspects of it.
Going back to the strategic component of the portfolios, one kind of recurrent theme when you look at asset class expectations from some of the big firms is that foreign stocks may outperform U.S. over the next decade. Is that something that you believe as well, and how does that get expressed in your client portfolios?
Yeah, we've always believed in an international exposure. Intellectually, looking at academic research would suggest you should invest in accordance with world market allocations, which would mean upwards of 50%. We've never had anywhere near that international commitment. We also are very sensitive to the behavioral aspects of clients being focused on your home country, whatever country you come from. But where it comes into play in our planning is, again, is in the strategic design of our portfolio. So we may somewhat increase the international exposure vis-a-vis the domestic. So, you know, it may have been at 27%. We may go up to 33% or something of that nature. So do I agree with the long-term opportunity of international versus domestic? The answer is I do. Over time, we expect the returns of domestic and international to be somewhat the same. The main value of the diversification is because they move in different patterns. They're not perfectly correlated. The bad news is, over the last decade or so, they've become much more correlated. So we're getting less benefit from diversification than we have in the past. But at least we believe there's still some benefit to diversification.
Within the strategic portfolios, do clients get different allocations based on their life stage? So, for example, would the younger client get a heavier allocation to foreign stocks within his or her stock weighting? And would the older client perhaps get a bigger allocation to TIPS, whereas the younger client might get none? Do you mix things up based on life stage with respect to that strategic piece?
No, the answer is absolutely not. We do it based on two things, risk tolerance and return needs, what I call anchoring on the efficient frontier. Again, you know, we may have young clients with very substantial assets, very modest goals, and they can have what one would call a very conservative portfolio because they don't need substantial growth and they don't particularly want to take the risk to get it because they don't need it. On the other hand, we may have older clients with more constrained resources who need to invest much more closely to their maximum risk tolerance level. So age becomes a factor when, you know, we come into mortality. How long will they need the money? And for younger clients, certainly if they're comfortable, we have no problem having a much more heavily growth-oriented portfolio. Our maximum equity allocation is 80%. That allows us to do some rebalancing. When the market's going through the roof, then we can take some off the table and put it in bonds, and the market collapses. We've got some money in bonds that we can utilize to buy stock. So, you know, if we have younger clients and we're persuaded that they can live with a great deal of volatility, then they may very well end up with an 80% equity portfolio. But again, that's driven by, say, those two elements, their risk tolerance and their goals. You know, someone young, the goal may simply be, gee, I have no idea what my long-term goals are going to be. I'd just like to build up the biggest portfolio I possibly can. And so then they would have potentially a very high growth portfolio.
How active do you get in terms of rebalancing?
We're very proactive. We have really complex rebalance parameters. It's balancing the cost of rebalancing, because rebalancing is inherently tax inefficient because it means you're selling winners, buying losers. And then you've got transaction costs. And then also you have a certain momentum element in the markets that we want to take advantage of. So you don't want to get out, quote, too early. But rebalancing is one of the most powerful tools we have, because over time, it means you're, you know, buying low and selling high. The problem from a behavioral standpoint is that it's a hard sell, because it means that you're buying what everyone else wants to sell and selling what everyone else wants to buy. I think the worst period we went through was the Grand Recession. I think we rebalanced three times. And that's something we, at the very beginning of a relationship with new clients, we explain to them what rebalancing is and what we're doing, but remind them that it's going to feel terrible at the time, because it means we're buying stocks when the market's, you know, collapsing. The first time we rebalanced wasn't a real problem. The second time, you know, market kept going down, you do it again. Are you sure this is the right thing? The answer is yes. The third time was more difficult, but everyone went along, and then long term it paid off. As we tell people, if the markets don't recover, all bets are off anyway, and it really won't matter because we'll all be broke. So our belief is, over time, the domestic and world economy will go up. And rebalancing is an immensely powerful tool, painful though it is in the short term. So again, we are extremely proactive in our rebalancing, again, with sensitivity to taxes and transaction costs and momentum.
What are the triggers for that rebalancing? Is it at the asset class level, or do you do rebalancing at sort of the individual security or fund level? If maybe within your domestic equity portfolio, you have one holding that has managed to be a massive winner, even when the rest of the market hasn't performed as well. How do you handle that?
It's at the asset class and style level. We don't have individual securities, but it is, you know, down to, say, emerging markets or small cap value or something of that nature. So it's definitely drilled down to a pretty detailed level. You know, there are parameters. If it's a very small transaction, we may not do it because the cost outweighs the benefits, but it's a pretty complex process and one that we're constantly reviewing.
I think that we want to pick your brain a bit about things like security selection, retirement, and also sort of regulatory and governance facet. But before we did that, I think you had sounded a skeptical note earlier on the concept of human capital. And I wondered if you could just very briefly expand on that. You know, perhaps I'm wrong about that, and it does figure into the way you do planning for your clients. But if I heard you right, it sounds like perhaps it doesn't. Can you explain?
Well, it does. Inherent to the planning process. We're factoring in guesstimates as to what kind of savings are our clients going to be making over the future, where they're going to be making those savings. So their human capital certainly comes into play just in the basic planning process. If someone is, say, a salesman and strictly living off of commissions as opposed to a tenured professor, that gets built into the planning process. We look at it in terms of what we call stress testing. You know, for a tenured professor, there's not a whole lot of stress testing to be done in terms of what might happen to their income stream. If someone is a car salesman, then we're going to be looking at the risk of a substantial hit on their income stream. So that goes into the discussion and education process regarding their risk tolerance. And it certainly influences what our suggestions might be. But it's not the major element in terms of the design. It comes in, as I say, to that discussion about largely the risk tolerance level. If through the stress testing, they have a major hit, then maybe they can't afford to take a certain level of risk. So we might need to back off and reduce the equity allocation or the stock bond balance in there.
You and I have talked a lot about retirement planning over the years, Harold, and I'd like to get your take on some of the research that's been done over the past 5 or so years in the realm of what in-retirement asset allocation should look like. I'd like to get your take on the reverse glide path research from Michael Kitsis and Wade Fow, where, you come in with a relatively low equity allocation and then ramp that up once you're through the danger zone. Have you implemented anything like that in client portfolios?
No, we haven't. I'm very familiar with it. And I believe that it's very sound, very credible research. We're kind of in the middle. The broad sort of emotional concept is in media, as you get older, you reduce your equity, which we don't believe in. To the extent I believe in anything, I think that their research is credible and makes sense. But my primary focus is a behavioral. And I think from a behavioral standpoint, it's not a particularly supportable solution. Once we determine what someone's risk tolerance is, typically we will be designing a portfolio unless they simply don't need the return. The goals don't suggest it. But if we believe someone can live with a 60% equity portfolio, we're not likely to start out at 40 and then move them up to 70 or 80 as they get older, because our belief is that if things get really bad, they won't live with it. So intellectually, I think it's very sound research. From a behavioral standpoint, I don't think that it's realistic.
Well, speaking of behavior, let's talk about the bucket approach, which is largely a behavioral strategy for retirement planning. Let's talk about the genesis of that in your practice, how you use it to the extent that you use it in your practice today, and whether you view it as mainly kind of a client illustration tool or whether it's something that you think about when sketching out what client asset allocation should look like in retirement.
No, it's a fundamentally real substantive aspect of our planning as opposed to discussion. Many, many years ago, I became well aware of the risk of sequence of withdrawal. And the way to manage that is to basically prevent clients from having to liquidate portions of their portfolio that are substantially underwater, you know, in a serious market correction. So when I originally started thinking about it and developing something, I thought it needed to be fairly simple and clear and understandable. And that's when I said, well, let's look at what a client is going to need to supplement their basic, you know, living standards, you know, not extra dollars, but just what's that marginal amount they're going to need. Originally, I said, let's carve out 2 years worth of that cash flow and literally put that in another portfolio, basically in money market and or short-term bonds or CDs, so that if the market fell apart, our clients would not have to liquidate the investment portfolio, which we continue to beat over their head as long-term, 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 and that they would be able to draw down off of what we call the cash flow reserve portfolio. The way we manage that portfolio is as we manage the investment portfolio, we're rebalancing. You know, we look over and say, oh, gee, that cash flow reserve is a little low. As we sell some bonds to buy stock, let's take a little bit of it and fill it back up again. So we control when we have to sell something from the investment portfolio. We updated that research a number of years ago. I did along with two other professors and concluded that 1 year was an adequate reserve. I'm aware of the criticism of the inefficiency of doing that because clearly there's an opportunity cost in setting up a cash flow reserve portfolio. But my belief is and my experience is that relatively small opportunity cost is way overweighed by the behavioral benefits because I did this, we did it in the early 80s, I guess. We went through the 87 crash, the tech bust, the Grand Recession, and clients may not have been happy, but no one was panicked. No one felt they had to sell out because they knew where their grocery money was coming from. Well, that cash flow reserve, we set it up and, you know, you can do it whether it's in a Merrill or a Schwab. We set it up to pay out a check once a month. So as Dina says, it's like the payroll syndrome. People are used to getting a regular check that they can pay their grocery bills from. And so it's been an immensely effective strategy. It's never happened, but should we ever have a case where the opportunity cost impacted the plan, our belief is that we could slightly nudge up the investment portfolio to offset that. So in other words, if someone, based on our risk tolerance and planning, thought they could live with 60% stock, we might increase it to 65%, slightly beyond what we had determined their risk tolerance, because with that cash flow reserve, we think that they would be able to survive a scary market. Again, we've never had to do that. The other bucket approaches, and I know we've talked before, have a great deal of appeal, but I don't think they make any sense. You know, there's the time bucket approach. Never quite understood that one because it would seem to me that as time goes on, what happens is the buckets down the road are progressively higher in equities. So at some point, you're likely to blow past someone's risk tolerance level. The goal bucket approach really doesn't make any sense because clients' goals are not chronological. So you're very likely to be overfunding a short goal and end up underfunding a future goal. Plus, they're more complicated and they're clearly more tax and cost inefficient because you've got far more moving parts. So I believe that simple little two-bucket approach has proved immensely viable over time.
So when you think about your clients from back in the 80s to where they are now, what are some of the major changes you've observed in the way their retirements have played out? Are people working longer? Are there any sort of generalizations you can make about how the complexion of retirement has changed?
Not from my clients. Most of my clients have pretty much followed the path that they expected to. Some work longer. Not because they have to, but because they want to, and they always have wanted to. Others have retired on their target period. Certainly, I believe that individuals, for the most part, will need to be working longer, because if indeed we have a lower return environment than I believe, people are going to need more resources than they've saved. And obviously, every year you work longer has a substantial impact on the survivability of your nest egg. I think I may have told you before, my favorite story was an elderly doctor that came in and I did a plan for. He was in his 80s and he only worked a couple of days a week. And when I finished the plan, when he came in, I said, "Doctor, you better sit down." He said, "Okay." I said, I've done this plan and I think if you keep working, it's going to cost you about $30,000 a year because you're not making very much and, you know, all your insurance and overhead." And he looked crushed. And I said, "My recommendation is you keep working." And he said, "Harold, that makes no sense." I said, "It makes all the sense in the world. If you quit working, it's going to cost you probably $60,000 in psychiatric bills because you're going to be so miserable. And you have a very substantial estate. You know, your family's not going to notice $30,000 a year or less for a number of years. So, you know, have a good time, you know. You know, wines are my hobby. When I drink them, they're all gone. That's not a very good investment." So I said, "I think it's a great investment in your future." So that sort of thing hasn't changed. That's still the kind of advice that we give people today.
Maybe shifting gears a bit to talk about the regulatory dimension, if we can. You've been a strong proponent for a fiduciary standard for some time for anyone that's rendering financial advice, so to speak. And so curious to get your reaction, what you think of the SEC's new measure, regulation best interest.
Yes, most depressing. Probably one of the most depressing things is the title of it. My basic belief or conclusion is there were two motivating factors. The SEC said the new rule was to give investors more information without uprooting Wall Street's commission-based sales model. More information means more disclosure. And I'm sure you've all seen lots of prospectuses. That's the loser of a solution. And protecting Wall Street's commission-based sales model, my question is, where's the protection of the investor? You know, when they called it best interest, they didn't define best interest. I think it was Jason Zweig did an article not long ago saying what a disaster this is likely to be, because it's simply going to mislead the public in that they're going to believe they're getting the same kind of protections they get from a fiduciary, which is simply nonsense. So, you know, disclosure seems to be the SEC's answer. And that, at least in my opinion, clearly not a reasonable solution. Not only that, they went on to say, informed consent does not require an advisor to make an affirmative determination that the client understood the disclosure. I didn't even understand some of the things that they said. Said, I've done expert witness work over 20 years. And my whole focus has been on issues of suitability. And the defense has always been, we told the client, you know, we disclosed everything to them. It's like, tough luck, they didn't understand it. So, no, I think all in all, it's an unmitigated disaster.
So we talked to Michael Kitsis a couple weeks ago, and he's a big believer in competency standards in addition to fiduciary standards for people proffering financial advice. Are you supportive of some minimum competency standards for advisors as well?
I think that would be great, but I mean, that's so far beyond where we are now. My energies and thoughts would mostly focus on just doing some of the basic things. I know you're familiar with the little oath that we developed. I mean, if we could simply get the SEC to adopt that little oath, that would go a long way. And the oath is, we will act with prudence at the skill, care, diligence, and good judgments of a professional. basically, that's the ERISA professional expert standard. That incorporates competency. The key is that it's up to the advisor to be able to defend themselves. So I'm not sure that simply putting competency as a requirement is going to be a whole lot of protection unless the responsibility falls on the advisor's shoulder. And that's the fundamental difference between the brokerage and the RIA. The brokerage, if there's an issue and a fight, the buck stops with the client. The client, in effect, has to, quote, prove that the broker did something wrong. The investment advisor, the buck stops with the advisor. So to me, that's where the focus needs to be. What are the standards and who's responsible? And if the standards are the good judgment of a professional and the responsibility is the advisor, then that subsumes the whole issue of competency.
So backing up to the oath, just to explain what we're talking about there, that's sort of a document that a client would put in front of an advisor and say, sign this, you will be required to be a fiduciary and so forth for me if you sign on the dotted line here. That was the basic idea.
Yeah, but it does say, the title just says putting your client's interest first. And it just has, six simple principles. Can't remember if the word fiduciary is in there. The idea is it's real black and white. It's something everyone can understand. There's no legalese in it. And there is no earthly reason anyone could possibly not be willing to sign it, these five principles. Now, I'm aware that some firms, the compliance department may say, well, you can't sign it, but that's a huge red flag. If I were a client, I'd say, how come? If they said the compliance department said I couldn't, I said, that's not good enough. I'd go looking somewhere else. I mean, lack in our client's best interest. Lack with prudent skill, care, and diligence, good judgment of professional. Again, that's the ERISA standard. That subsumes competency. Will not mislead clients, provide conspicuous, full, fair disclosure of all facts, avoid conflicts of interest, and then fully disclose and fairly manage in our client's favor any avoidable conflicts. That's it. I mean, it's so simple. They don't need 100-something pages or whatever that report finally is. But that would cut through all of this discussion. It wouldn't matter if you're a broker or if you're an investment advisor. This is good for anybody.
That sounds like a good, decisive note to end on. Harold, we really appreciate your time today. Always appreciate your insights. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. Y'all have a good afternoon.
Thanks. You too, Harold.
Thanks again.
Y'all take care. Bye now.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Long View from Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number one.
Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Batak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.